Donald Jeffries. My first book was published in 2007, and I went by Donald. I don't know why, and so I've kept it consistent. Nobody really called me Donald before that, so most people call me Don. I go back in terms of down these rabbit holes. I didn't have an epiphany. I've been awake my entire adult life since I was a teenager. First started in, you know, researching the JFK assassination in the mid 1970s when I was a teenager, and I ended up volunteering for Mark Lane, who was a hero of mine, wrote Rush to Judgment, who was the most prominent critic of the Warren Commission. I was a volunteer for his organization, Citizens Committee of Inquiry. We lobbied Congress to try to get them to reopen the assassination investigation, which they eventually did under the House Select Committee. They're disappointing, but we did help get them to do that. So that's still my wheelhouse issue. I was obsessed with it as a teenager and into my 20s. And then eventually I became disillusioned. I still, you know, obviously knew about it and paid attention to it. But I was a very left-wing Democrat. I thought the Democrats were the good guys. I was a card-carrying member of the ACLU at a young age and Kennedy fanboy, all that stuff. But eventually I became much more cynical, and I started discovering right-wing conspiracies like Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and Bohemian Grove and all these things. And certainly when Bill Clinton was president, opened up a whole new world to me. And my book in history, I called it the Conspiracy Central when he was there. So now I'm just a populist. I'm far left-wing on some issues, far right-wing on some other issues. People can't really figure out what I am. But I end up attracting all kinds of people because they like certain elements of what I'm saying, but I'm definitely not any kind of never will be mistaken for a conservative, although people more likely will associate me with the right wing now because I hate the woke, so-called woke liberalism.
Well, now, apparently, if you support the idea of a mixed economy where the government actually controls the infrastructure of the country, you're now supposed to be a right winger, which is absolutely unbelievable in so many ways, because the left seems to have come over to the right. And then, Mark Lane, obviously a very, very important figure. Can you just say something about him? Because obviously you knew him, met him and knew him.
Yeah, he's my hero. And he was, I'm not going to say he was my mentor, but to me he was, but he, I looked at him as a philosophical role model, and he was a civil libertarian. I discovered what civil libertarianism means because of him. And, he was a Jew, and you know, he would defend people that were considered anti-Semitic. And I loved that idea, much as I love the fact that the ACLU is defending Nazis marching in Skokie, Illinois back then. People who, not today, everybody calls anybody they don't like a Nazi. It has no meaning. But these people were saying they were Nazis, proudly saying it. And this Jewish lawyer, Goldenberger from the ACLU, he defended the right to do it. And so that's what civil libertarian means to me. And I got that from Mark Lane. Mark Lane continued to be that way for the rest of his life. So obviously, I greatly admire him. He was he had a lot of media presence. He was the most media presence of any critics of the Warren Commission. But, people have also been suspect of him because he was Jim Jones' attorney in Guyana, and he didn't die. You know, a lot of people think he's suspect just because of that, which I think is kind of ridiculous. But very interesting fellow. And, obviously, like I said, it was one of the thrills of my life to meet him. And,
well, he's a kind of great person to have as your schoolmaster, isn't he? Well, what can you take us through some of the books that you've written so far then?
Yeah, well, I'm primarily a novelist. That's what I want to be. I think of myself as. So my first book published was a novel called The Unreals, 2007. And I'm still proud of it, although it was written mostly when I was very young. So it's a young man's book. But I've written other novels since then that I think are my best work. And I can't get anybody to read them, even though I've had, you know, 9 nonfiction books published after that. But I turned to nonfiction out of frustration because I couldn't get anywhere with my fiction. And so I wrote Hidden History, which ended up being by far my most successful book. That was published in 2014. And it was 7 years, you know, between the novel and that, because I was trying to, you know, write and get my fiction published, and it just wasn't working. So Hidden History is a kind of an encyclopedia. It's it sold by far most of any of my books and still gets talked about the most of it. But it's a resource for people who may not be experts on conspiracies, but may know something about it. You don't have to read it in order. You can go around. I want to read about, TWA 800, or I want to read about Oklahoma City, whatever. You can just go to that part of the book and read it. So people like that format. And so with such good response from it, after that, I wrote, I had this book in me because I'm a human.
Hang on. Before you skip over that, it's interesting you use that title, Hidden Histories, because we've been following the Hidden History YouTube channel, which has been outing over the last couple of years the very, very strong evidence that there is in the archives for the Nazis developing nuclear weapons way before the Allies, and certainly before the Manhattan Project, and then using it as a bargaining chip at the end of the war, realizing that whilst they could nuke New York or London, it wasn't going to win them the war. It was worth much more as a kind of bargaining chip. So Hidden Histories is the thing. Could you just take two examples out of your book for the listeners of, because this is what we understand in the post-Orwellian world, that we've been lied to, not just recently, but for decades and for centuries, about the really important threads that have been running through history. So pick a couple out of your bits of Hidden History.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been lied to about everything. That's why I said I don't discount anything when everybody says, so many people believing everything is fake now, but it's understandable because we are lied to constantly. So I think Hidden History is the most notable thing about it, I believe, is the section on the JFK Jr. death, John F. Kennedy Jr. I was the first one to independently investigate that. I talked to JFK Jr.'s high school sweetheart, to a member of his adult inner circle who very strongly requested to remain anonymous. And another journalist as well, Wayne Madsen, and it's very clear from all these people that behind the scenes, JFK Jr. had an obsession with his father's assassination. He was reading the same books I was. We could have been great friends if I could have run in his circles during that time. But I found that fascinating because the Kennedy family is has been notable, unfortunately, for ignoring this subject and speaking out like Martin Luther King's family did. They spoke out strongly. And then later RFK Jr. would. But JFK Jr. behind the scenes was doing this. So it has a nice long section on that, and people can read it. Once you read it, you'll realize that you've been lied to about that. Clearly it wasn't. Let's just put it this way. I talked to the person who wrote the official weather report for that night for the FAA, Eugene Meyer, and he is still mad to this day at the way the media misrepresented anything. As he pointed out, the weather was not hazy. It was perfectly fine flying conditions. JFK Jr. was not reckless. All of this stuff that came out, it was lies. And this is the guy that wrote the official weather report. So I think that's an important part of the book. And so I would say that. And, the book has, obviously I have a lot on the JFK assassination, because that's my wheelhouse issue. And what I did there is I just kind of put everything together in about 80 to 100 pages. I distilled, what I consider the essence of it down to that, because, there's a lot of minutia that gets thrown there that means something to people like me, but it's not going to mean something to the average person. So who isn't obsessed with this stuff. But I think anybody reading those 80 to 100 pages is going to come away with knowing, obviously, whoever killed JFK, it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, so we've been lied to about that. So that's obviously important. And then I talk about things that have been completely forgotten. Like people would contact me and say, wow, I forgot all about that. And, one of the things I cover is a couple of things I cover. One of them was this guy, R. Bud Dwyer, who was the Pennsylvania state treasurer, excuse me, who very memorably, he made headlines by blowing his brains out during a live press conference in 1987. And as I pointed out, every media report at the time said that, they made it portray this. Well, obviously, this would be crazy to shoot himself at a press conference. And they invariably said he read after reading a long, rambling statement. Now, they didn't say anything about what was in the long, rambling statement. But I read the long, rambling statement because it was published in a newspaper called The Spotlight, which has been smeared as anti-Semitic. But they're the only ones, and they interviewed his widow as well. The long rambling statement was a detailed indictment against the governor of the state, which was then Richard Thornburgh, who later became George Bush the First, his attorney general. And it was, you know, full of, you know, in, you know, allegations of incredible corruption on a personal level, just, you know, using things for his family and things like that. And also more serious financial scandals. And Thornburgh went after him and targeted him and tried to prosecute him as well. And Dwyer thought that by killing himself like that, he would bring attention to it. But he was naive enough, so he didn't understand that we have a completely state-controlled press here in this country. So even though representatives from all different media outlets were there, no one said anything about what he was talking about.
Well, look, you're talking here about George Herbert Walker Bush, the first Bush.
Yes.
So Bush Sr.
Yes.
I mean, he was an ex-CIA director, wasn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. And we have
the CIA, which is protecting him, which is a very strong influence on the mass media through Operation Mockingbird and things like this. I mean, as an ex-mass media person myself, I think it'd be worth you saying, you know, just how much actually does get through the mass media in the United States. How do you think things are going over there?
Well, now we have, with Trump has changed the situation so much because he's in the middle of everything now. And everything, you know, Trump's enduring legacy may be the concept of just saying fake news. And it is all fake, but the problem is both sides now use fake news. So if something comes out they don't like from anybody, they just say it's fake. But you mentioned Operation Mockingbird, and one of the most notable disclosure we've had from DOGE so far, the Department of Government Efficiency that Elon Musk was running, when he was looking at USAID, which is really a subsidiary of the CIA, we've discovered now. But one of the things that was in there was that there were 6,200 journalists all over the world, not just American journalists, 6,200 journalists that were on USAID's payroll. They were on the U.S. government's payroll. So to me, that's a massive extension of Operation Mockingbird. So we don't know. And again, that was just kind of glossed over. And we don't know the details on it. Who were these journalists? Yeah. How much were they paid? So the state of the media in this country is just horrible. I mean, I don't believe anything they say. And I've compared the American media to TASS and Pravda at the height of the Soviet Union. I don't think it's any different. The difference is that the Soviet Union back then, they were smart enough and unbrainwashed enough to realize they were being lied to. Yet at least half of America, if not more, are so brainwashed and so stupid, frankly, that they believe that CNN and MSNBC and even most Fox News and New York Times, Washington Post, they believe these are independent outlets that are telling them the truth, and they're just feeding them. Talk about misinformation nonstop. They lie about everything. When the JFK files were released recently, the New York Times, who has never told one word of truth about the JFK assassination over 60 years, they had a headline saying, JFK files release, hint, Oswald still did it. It's like, what? That's where we're at. So I don't have any confidence in our media.
Now, listen, I mean, I'm talking to, I think it's fair to say, a JFK assassination expert. Why do you think this event in 1963, there's been so much focus on it? What does it mean for the United States and for the world, that assassination?
Well, it doesn't mean a lot to people who were born later, but certainly, I mean, I was seven when it happened, so I came in at the tail end of the baby boomers, and the baby boomers especially, this was like 9/11 would be to millennials. You know, it was our seminal event, and my memories, you know, on a consistent line, I have, you know, memories before that, but they're kind of chopped up. But JFK assassination is kind of where my timeline starts, you know, where I remember things from that point on, because had such an impact on me. And we were a Catholic family, and they loved the Kennedys. And I saw, you know, first time I saw my dad crying, to people crying, and there were discussions in the house. My dad didn't believe the story. He never thought Oswald did it. So I soaked all that in. So yeah.
Let's get into that, because there have been some interesting revelations way outside of the mainstream press to do with a guy called James Files from the Chicago Mafia, who's a hitman there, and Johnny Roselli, Jack Nicoletti, who allegedly were down in Dallas that day, and doing a job for the Central Intelligence Agency, their controller, according to the one surviving member of the three-man team, who's James Files, was at the CIA, their controller is a guy called James Attlee Phillips, and that much of this was being done because the Texas oil people didn't like Kennedy, and there's also connections with the Kennedy's scuppering of the Bay of Pigs invasion and the plans that there were to kill Castro and take over Cuba, which were neutered by Kennedy when he said that no, he didn't want the United States Air Force to be supporting this attack. So, I mean, I've given you a brief outline there of what people like James Files and people that follow him have been saying. And he actually says he used a Remington Fireball on the grassy knoll to blow the back of JFK's head off, basically, in Wim Dankbar's interview that he did with him in prison, when he was in prison. So this seems to me to be a pretty good scenario. What's yours?
Well, you know, people ask me that. I have no evidence other than I think that I think the mafia has always been, and I'm familiar with Files' story. I don't know. You know, people that we've had other people that have confessed belatedly, and you know, whether knowing the actual gunman's name, it's possible he could have been. We don't really know who the gunman were. I'm more interested in who were the people that were planned the conspiracy and hired the gunman. And I think that the recent fire releases, I think point more towards the CIA definitely as an institution. And also, ironically, they mentioned Israel a whole lot of times. These fire releases were notable for, they had been released before, these files. And the redactions, when they came out this time without redactions, thanks to Tulsi Gabbard, most of the things that were no longer redacted had to do with Israel. There's even one document, an FBI document that says at the bottom was written in. CIA says everything's okay for release except bracketed portions. All the bracketed portions are about Israel. I don't know what that means, but it means something. And I think that you mentioned David Attlee Phillips, who a lot of people talk about, but I believe that James J. Angleton in the CIA, and these files talk so much about Angleton. I think it's pretty clear now that Angleton would have been the point man in the CIA. And I don't think it was just the CIA that killed him. I think people in the Pentagon, like Curtis LeMay, Dr. Strangelove, and Alan Dulles was outside the CIA then, but I think he was part of it. I think Lyndon Johnson knew about it. And it's possible the Federal Reserve was involved. I'm still looking for that.
Interesting you mentioning Israel, because at the time, JFK was trying to stop the Israelis obtaining nuclear weapons, wasn't he?
Yes.
The Dimona was becoming active. This is a mix. I mean, you know, the old Sherlock Holmes thing. You're looking for means, motive, and opportunity, aren't you? The motive, absolutely right. Key.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's... Again, I don't think, because a lot of people now in the alt media are saying these files prove Israel killed JFK. You know, I think our government was definitely, you know, the impetus behind it. And certainly so I don't think Israel certainly did it by themselves, but, and they couldn't have. I don't think they could have gotten the Secret Service to stand down, which the Secret Service did stand down and make it possible. I don't think they could have gotten the entire mainstream media to lie about it for over 60 years now. And they continue to lie about it. So I think that it was probably, a group. And again, Angleton, the reason why I think Angleton's name is important is because he was the Mossad's connection to the CIA. He was so popular in Israel, Angleton was, that he has a memorial built to him in Israel. So I think the fact that he's named all over these documents, we know now that he recruited Lee Harvey Oswald himself out of the Marines when Oswald was 20 years old, and he kept tabs on him at least for the next 4 years until he was killed. And we know now that the week before the assassination, there was a 198-page file on Angleton's desk on Lee Harvey Oswald. So that's the kind of stuff that obviously would have been looked into in a real investigation. But anyway, you asked why this is important. I think, again, the mafia, they tend to, and, you know, I wrote one of the books I wrote with a guy named William Long, great researcher, called Pipe the Bimbo in Red, and it's about Jim Garrison's investigation, and Dean Andrews, one of the characters, I know his, got to know his son very well, he's become a good friend of mine, he's my brother's friend, and now he's my friend, But we talk about the New Orleans investigation there. And when you mentioned Cuba and the Bay of Pigs and everything, I think the Mafia and Cuba have both been smokescreens that have been designed to lead researchers in the wrong direction. Because as I've said, I think I'm the only one saying in the research community, if Cuba was a motive for them to kill JFK, then they failed. Because after the assassination, there was no second Bay of Pigs. There was not even an attempt. They stopped trying to assassinate Castro, and Castro outlived them all. So, I mean, in fact, Cuba died as a campaign issue. Cuba was not mentioned in the 1964 election. You'd think Goldwater would have made a big deal out of it. No, he didn't. And Nixon never did or said anything about it when he was in there. So I think this is a smokescreen. In our book, we showed how there's tons of Cuban figures that are were around Oswald. But I think Lee Harvey Oswald was an undercover agent. We know he's with the CIA. I think he was with the FBI as well. There's evidence to suggest that one of those two agencies assigned him at the time of the assassination. He was assigned to infiltrate a group that he was told was plotting to kill the president. I think that group included Jack Ruby, David Ferry, Clay Shaw, Guy Bannister, and all those anti-Castro Cubans. So I think that's how he got connected. I think they were all being manipulated each other. None of them were associated with the real conspiracy. They were all being used, I think. But so I think these are much bigger people than
I suppose also by looking at what's going on in Israel now with this genocide unfolding, the horrifying, basically bringing hell to the Holy Land, you can see maybe that there were plans afoot many decades ago for this sort of power to be concentrated in this kind of crusader state there. But look, you know, I stopped you when you were just going to go on to your next book, Don.
I think we talked because The Hidden History, obviously, is again my bestseller. And I wrote Survival of the Richest after that, and that's my economic book. And that's my far left wing book. You know, so people, it really gets people confused. I think I'm a communist reading that, but I'm a populist. And Huey Long, the former governor of Louisiana, that's my all time political hero. And I think I've single handedly tried to restore Huey Long's reputation. I've communicated with his great granddaughter. We've had several conversations, and Huey Long was a great man. Our government definitely killed him. There's no question that I share that in my book. But Survival of the Richest.
So for our British audience, who is this guy and what happened?
He was the governor of Louisiana, and he called him the Kingfish. And if you go, you know, can find speeches on YouTube or whatever, just you'll get a sense of how magnetic he was still. And this guy was as colorful a character as you'll ever find. He was brilliant. The Supreme Court Justice William Howard Taft said that he was the most brilliant lawyer to ever argue before the Supreme Court. And I don't think he was even 30 years old when he did that. He was elected governor of Louisiana and at a young age, and he basically rebuilt the state. He had a national movement called Share Our Wealth, and he recognized the disparity of wealth, and he wanted to ensure, because he recognized how much wealth was there then. There's obviously even more now. And he realized that if it was just shared a little bit more fairly, and as he said, his tax plan would have exempted the first $1 million of income from any tax at all. That would be about $12 million today. So nobody but the absolute top tier of the 1% would have been paying taxes. So obviously they had interest. The Rockefeller Standard Oil was constantly clashing with him. He predicted his assassination on the floor of the Senate because then he was elected to the Senate. And but before he got through with the Louisiana, he paved the entire state. He built the first free healthcare clinics. He was the first one to ensure that prisoners got healthcare. They didn't get healthcare before that. Hospitals, and he built schools, he built LSU University. So he did many great things, and he saved the average person substantial costs on utilities. He eliminated personal property taxes for all but the very, very wealthy. So he was a great man, and he would be, you know, he must be worrying at warp speed at his grave over what's going on now. But that's my most critically acclaimed book. If you read look on the Amazon page, it has tons of people like, I think President Carter's Council of Economic Advisors guy, like, all these people liked it, but it didn't sell that well. So I went back to, after that, I basically wrote Hidden History 2, which is Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. That's kind of the prequel to it, and it goes back to the beginning, to the War for Independence, and all the way up to the Kennedy assassination. And Ron Paul, the great Ron Paul, wrote the foreword to that. I was, you know, incredibly honored. He's been a hero of mine as well. And that was the book where I really, I think, exposed a lot of readers to the truth about Abraham Lincoln. And I convinced a lot of people, I think, that, you know, this guy was our biggest tyrant, not our greatest hero. So we looked at FDR differently. We examined.
Hey, come on. Let's hear a bit about naughty old Abe Lincoln.
Yeah. Well, again, it goes, and I, you know, Lincoln was a hero of mine too, before I, but, you know, I, when you look at the actual record, you realize, wow, this guy, he, everything, all the problems we have in, not all, but most of the problems we have in America today with this tyrannical authoritarianism, this overreach of government, comes from Lincoln. Lincoln, you know, all the presidents before Lincoln, except one, Polk, who invaded Mexico, and that was not good. He overstepped his boundaries. But every other one, no matter what party they were in, they knew the limits of their constitutional powers. Lincoln did not. He thought he had unlimited powers. And from the very get-go, I mean, he suspended the writ of habeas corpus, which nobody had ever dared to do before. So when you look at the January 6th prisoners, obviously, you know, all those years later, 160 years later, whatever, Lincoln set that precedent. Because we still don't know how many thousands of Northerners he threw into prisons, to makeshift prisons, for just opposing his policies. And they had no charges against him because the writ of habeas corpus had been suspended. So you had people spending time in prison, dying in prison, for no reason at all, because they opposed his policy. And it was like a hysteria, you know, so your neighbors could report you for some, you know, really stupid thing, the way you held your hand or something. And the troops could arrest them. People were arrested in church. They were arrested in the middle of the night. Their homes were broken into. So the story of it is in my book. And I was influenced by Professor Thomas DiLorenzo, who wrote The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked, and did a great job showing that. But Lincoln shut down over 250 newspapers. The point was, the entire war was unnecessary, because if he had just let the original, and it's what's important to remember is that when we fought, you guys know we went against England, but with the reason we wanted to secede from England. That's what we wanted to do. And the Confederacy in America, they called themselves the Confederacy for a reason, because our original document was not the Constitution, it was the Articles of Confederation. So they chose that name for a reason, that, hey, we're going to go back to what we were supposed to be. They thought the Constitution gave the government too much power. A lot of people still feel that. So when they wanted to secede, the southern states said, we no longer want to be a part of this union. Lincoln should have just said, I mean, look at what Thomas Jefferson wrote. Whenever the people, tire of this kind of government, they have the right to alter or abolish it. And the idea that we were founded on as an independent nation was the consent of the governed, that all people have a right to consent to those who govern them. In 1860, obviously, those Confederate states no longer consented. So when Lincoln said, no, you can't leave, this is not a voluntary union, you do not have the right to consent to those who govern you, he shattered the foundation of the American Revolution. And the conservatives, especially Republicans, worshiped this guy. Oh, my God, Honest Abe. And by the way, Honest Abe, the reason he was called Honest Abe is the same reason you would call a bald guy curly. He was so dishonest that his critics called him Honest Abe. So that's, again, this hidden history. And people think, oh, he was so honest. No, he was not honest. He was he was so bad. This guy was a stooge. Huey Long, my hero, he famously said, I never would take a case against a poor man. I don't think Lincoln ever took a case for a poor man as a lawyer. He was a tool of the railroads and corporate interests. And he actually, believe it or not, great emancipator, he actually defended a slave owner when he was trying to get his runaway slave back. Now, how many Americans do you think that would think, oh, my God, Honest Abe, of course, would defend the runaway slave? He's the greatest. No, he defended the slave owner.
So, hey, hang on. This is a bit like Mark Lane defending the Nazis.
Mark Lane did.
So, look, I think it's useful because in the UK, sometimes the whole idea of a War of Independence and a Civil War kind of blend into each other. Right. The 18th century blends into the 19th century, and we get a bit fuzzy-brained about the United States. But you're quite right. The War of Independence I'll be just hearing from Michael Hudson recently on our show here that war was about money. It was about the United States' ability to rely on and control its own money system, the colonial money system, right. Whereas the British wanted to impose their system on the United States, and that was what really was at the fundamental back of the War of Independence. But the Civil War, this, it seems to me, was, I mean, you please do correct me, but it seems to me was a lot to do with the concentration of power in Washington that a lot of people in the United States weren't happy with. We're sold this kind of lie. It's very interesting talking about all this stuff, because we were just saying about the Kennedy assassination being about Cuba. Maybe it was actually really about Israel. And maybe that's this whole idea of concentrating power in Washington was really what the Civil War was all about. It was nothing to do with slavery.
No, I don't think it was. And if you look at Lincoln's record, first of all, Lincoln gave speeches in his 1858 Senate campaign against Stephen Douglas. He gave speeches that would read like something the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan would say. And that's no offense to Lincoln, because to be fair, 99% of the white people back then believed that. They would be considered, that's just the way the world was. They considered themselves superior. I mean, these beings were slaves, so of course they felt they were superior to them. So Lincoln was no different than that. But he didn't become enlightened in his first inaugural address. I think he mentioned the word slavery twice in the entire address. And he said, if I could say, he says, my job is to save the Union. And he said something. I don't think I have any right to stop slavery where it's at. I have no authority to do that. That's what he said originally. And of course, he very famously said, I just want to save the Union. If I could do it by freeing all the slaves, I will. If I could do it by freeing some of the slaves, I will. And if I could do it without freeing any of the slaves, I will. But a couple years into the war, it wasn't going so well, because the South had much better, tacticians. They were some real military strategists in the South, and the North did not. They just had an advantage in numbers. He decided to go to try to get sympathy of England and France and the rest of the world. He suddenly turned this into a moral crusade against slavery. Then suddenly it was about slavery. And then towards the end of the war, he suddenly, Lincoln, most of the evidence is that Lincoln was an atheist. And in fact, there's evidence that Lincoln in his youth was such an atheist that he wrote a rebuttal to the New Testament or something. And his friends found out about it and got him to burn it or something when he was going to enter politics. He can't have this out there on the record. So Lincoln, there's no evidence really that he believed in God, but he started talking about God a lot near the end of the war and blaming God for the war. He took that tact, the Almighty wants us. The only way the sins of this great land can be purged is through blood, of almost a million people. So I can't say enough bad things about Lincoln. The more I read about him, because the guy just, he set so many bad precedents. So the precedents he set of locking dissenters up who had committed no crime and were not even charged with any crime, they would be, Woodrow Wilson, another horrible president, would be used to do that in World War I when you had lots of people, anti-war protesters, like the great socialist Eugene Debs and others, Joseph Kennedy Sr., who was John F. Kennedy Jr.'s, John F. Kennedy's father, who was a great anti-war protester in World War I and World War II. He didn't lock up Kennedy, but he locked up a lot of people. And the Supreme Court ended up ruling that he could do that. And most people don't know that. I found that out when researching that book. That's where the asterisk on our First Amendment comes from, that you've heard that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. That came from the Supreme Court ruling of Oliver Wendell Holmes, great liberal, eugenicist, pro-war guy, who used that as an example of why Wilson could lock up anti-war protesters. And I pointed out, however you look at it, protesting a war is not yelling fire in a crowded theater. But the average American doesn't know that. They just nod their heads, and it's like, that's where that comes from. So Wilson used Lincoln's precedent to do that. And then Roosevelt, FDR, probably the only president that can match Lincoln in terms of being awful. And again, that's why the court historians love him. Roosevelt locked up a bunch of people that protested the war too, and also incarcerated not just the Japanese, but Germans and Italians as well in concentration camps in America during World War II. Stole all their property. My latest book, American Memory Hole, tells how they stole billions of dollars of homes and businesses from these people and never gave it back after the war. They just absolutely stole it. But Roosevelt used, again, he used what Wilson had done as the president. Wilson used Lincoln. And go even to George W. Bush, in the early 2000s, his attorney used Lincoln's incarceration of Northern prisoners as an excuse for why they could treat the prisoners we had, the alleged terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, the way we did. So these Lincoln set tons of horrible precedents, and it shattered the consent of the government forever. And most people don't realize that before the Civil War, before the war between the states, the United States, when people talked about the United States, they talked about it in plural terms. They would say the United States are a great place to live. And after the war, it became singular. The United States is.
Right. Yeah, this is interesting, isn't it? Because the idea is that the independent states, they're only really independent if they can take a vote to secede from Washington and just leave, you know, if they feel like it. And I sometimes hear rumors that maybe one state, mostly the one that crops up is Texas, might actually do that one day.
Yeah, well, we still talk about it. And I would love to. In America, I think you, to Great degree, England is the same. All the majority white countries are in kind of the same position because of the non-white migration and the clash of cultures. And you know, you're certainly seeing it over there with what's happening. And we had last year where you had the angry people out in the streets and the, you know, your official over there threatened to arrest Elon Musk and all. I don't know what happened. I guess the protests went away, but that's what happens here, where we don't see any kinds of protests. But we are completely divided culturally. You know, we have millions of people who, no matter how many movies, you know, Hollywood tells them to, or liberal politicians, how many teachers tell them, we're never going to believe that there's anything other than men and women. We're not going to believe there's 57 genders. We're not going to believe it's, you know, that somebody can change their pronouns to they, them. And you've got millions of Americans now that believe that, and that believe men can have babies. So just on a moral, you know, foundation, that can't stand.
Well, this is what they call the post-truth era, isn't it? The idea that, yeah, you've got interference and chaff and nonsense flying around in your brain. Therefore, you're not going to really be able to get yourself organized to take on a tyrannical government. But you mentioned a more recent book there. Can you just remind us now of the various titles you've been talking about? People are
interested. Oh, yeah. OK, so after that, I'm just kind of going in order. That Crimes and Cover-Ups is that one. The prequel that has the What's Up That Link and everything. Then I wrote a book about bullying and school bullyocracy. How the social hierarchy enables bullies to rule schools, workplaces, and society at large. I have lots and lots of examples how the schools are. I'm not a big fan of the schools. And I talked to plenty of parents whose kids killed themselves, even as young as elementary school, over being bullied because the schools did nothing about it. So I, even before COVID, when COVID hit, obviously we saw how bad the schools were. But then I wrote a book about COVID. That's my most censored book. It's been shadow banned everywhere. Barnes and Noble just deleted from their website. Amazon deleted the Kindle version. Apple Books was trying to charge $999 for it so people wouldn't buy it. Libraries blocked it. But that's called Masking the Truth, How COVID-19 Destroyed Civil Liberties and Shut Down the World. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, very notable doctor in the truth movement, wrote the foreword to it. That's, you know, I'm very proud of that book, but it's been very hard to get traction on it because I call COVID the greatest psyop in the history of the world. The book is completely documented, thoroughly documented. It shows how, we've been lied to relentlessly about it, and they could do it again because they got the entire world to shut down in a couple of days, and almost nobody protested. They didn't need a single troop, single police officer, no shots were fired.
Well, I can tell you there was some pretty good protests here in Bristol, which we were out on. I mean, there was a very strong, I think, here in the UK anyway,
COVID
movement, where the idea that you weren't allowed to come and protest because it was too dangerous, you might, we had loads of students at our two big universities in the city having COVID parties together, like, so they could catch it and spread it. And they knew that they weren't going to die of it, and that it was actually a good idea to catch it, to get immune to it. So, you know, there was a complete jarring of the official narrative and the mainstream media to the actual reality of this. You know,
I should have clarified that. Yeah, I know there were protests, and France had some, I know. It's just America had nothing. You know, America, we just rolled over and played dead, which we do a great job of now. But what I meant was that when they declared this, you know, emergency, and it was the entire world, the world rolled over in terms of the governments. Nobody balked. Putin didn't balk. The guy in Brazil later did, kind of. Once the vaccine was introduced, some of the people in Africa did. But at the beginning, nobody balked. And the entire world went by this nonsensical nonsense.
I think, for example, in Belarus, they had a pretty good reaction.
Yes.
India was also quite good in that they started getting ivermectin out to loads of people, and because it's one of the places that they were manufacturing it. From memory, one of the big South American countries, was it maybe Venezuela? I'm not sure, but they had also quite enlightened policies. But you know, it was a very interesting exercise. I'm not sure that it will work a second time. I think people would, I think this is the sort of thing, it's like once bitten, twice shy. But anyway, look, the reason I contacted you, Don, today was to talk about a more recent article that you've done. It's about fear. I hope you can just recount the headline for me, because you also mentioned my pet hate, which is the Bilderbergers. Actually, of course, as a good Christian, I love them all as human beings, but I do see that they've become very misguided souls. It would be nice if they weren't using their wealth and their technology to enslave humanity. I think they ought to turn away from their wicked ways. But anyhow, so how do you connect up the Bilderbergers with fear? How did you do that?
Well, I just, you know, I try to, when I write my Substack, is the only place I'm not shadow banned, and people can follow me there, DonaldJeffries.substack.com. It's called I Protest. They shadow ban me everywhere else. But Substack, at least for now, is a real true free speech platform, so I value it a lot. I use it a lot. I write there regularly. People can subscribe to me. But I try to use humor a lot. I mean, I have a wit, and people like it. I try to inject lightheartedness into everything, no matter how dark the subject is, because I think it's easier. I think we need to laugh at this stuff, because it's very sobering and dark and depressing. And so I try to find humor in it. So I kind of mess around with things and play around. So I wrote I titled it, What's Scarier Than a 33rd Degree Bilderberger? And obviously there's no such thing as a 33rd Degree Bilderberger. I'm kind of playing around with the 33rd Degree Masons as well as the Bilderbergers. But it's to I give examples of real life monsters, you know, in your neighborhood, you know, people that, like the guy John List, that was a normal family man and very religious, at his church and everything, and he just killed his three kids and his wife and his mother one day. And the most hideous part is the last son he killed, he went to his son's soccer game, watched him, cheered him on, drove him home, and then killed him. I mean, I that stuff terrifies me. You know, so I talked about, you know, Andrea Yates, the woman, again, religious. A lot of these people, unfortunately, are religious. And she just drowned her five kids one by one in the bathtub, all very small. Laid them out neatly on the bed. So, so my point was, yes, and many people remind me, of course, the Bilderbergers are worse, and, but, you know, the CIA and all this stuff. Yes, of course. I understand on a grander scale, they're doing much worse things. But as far as it is to an
individual, you're kind of spreading fear there, aren't you, by saying, hang on, never mind about the people who are really taking a profit out of you and manipulating you from afar. The real problem is next door.
Well, yeah, I wasn't meaning to, but again, I also look at some of these instances, and there's an underlying tone in the article and everything I write where I'm skeptical about these events, you know, that it may, or did they really happen, or it happened as they told? So, and is it just part of this? Because it does scare you. That terrifies you.
Well, yeah, I think it's absolutely right that there is a whole new kind of, well, I don't know quite how new it is, but it's certainly becoming quite well developed. The idea that an event is a scripted event as well as being a real event. So, you've got, it's almost as if suddenly the world in somebody's house or outside an airport or something will turn into kind of a movie set where people will be manipulated. Some actors will come in to play a part in that horrific drama, some terrorist attack or whatever. And then they'll disappear and a body will be left, you know. So this seems to be the way that much terrorism is carried out nowadays, certainly here in the West, is with some actors playing a part in there, the whole thing being scripted. And then, of course, it goes through a whole nother filter, which is what you're seeing on the TV and what goes through the court system, right. If anything. You know, normally there's quite a few bodies around and then they say, well, let's just have an inquest and there's no proper court case. So, I mean, that is quite worrying, isn't it, to think that when something happens, we've got no real... I mean, say, for example, one of the murders you were talking about or family murders, someone else could have come in and done that, potentially, and it's made it look as if this, you know, great pillar of the community had carried right. that action out.
Exactly. And you have things like Sandy Hook, for instance, that we've talked about. You have Alex Jones, that was the most prominent voice in the conspiracy world, that's been prosecuted, I think, 3 different times now for talking about that. And I told the people, look, I have studied Sandy Hook, and I think it's very questionable. There's a lot of questions about it. But I said, even no matter what, you can't say you can't talk about you that you can be prosecuted for something.
Well, hang on a minute. I think you can, you see, even though I'm a libertarian, you might say, journalist. Mm-hmm. I as a journalist, I think you have a responsibility that if people have been killed, you don't go around saying that these people haven't been killed and their right. loved ones that have lost their loved ones are lying. This is the sort of thing which, you know, really does stretch the boundaries of free speech. And we have someone, Richard D. Hall in the United Kingdom, who's been doing exactly that with the Manchester Arena bombing, where several people most definitely did die. The idea is that, oh, it's okay to just say, no, they didn't die. The whole thing was staged, and those that went to funerals were just pretending to go to funerals. Now, this right. really is, I think, from a journalistic point of view, an absolutely disgusting, travesty of journalism. And the idea, it seems to me, is to actually discredit all alternative journalists and to get draconian laws brought in to stop this kind of, you know, because if you have lost a loved one, to then have to put up with someone trying to rub salt in the wounds and saying, well, you're just lying. You haven't really lost a loved one at all. You know, this is right. this is really stretching the boundaries of free speech, Don, isn't it?
Well, no, I'm not saying it, but and like if Alex Jones was, and again, a lot of people think Alex Jones is disinfo and he's not legitimate either.
Well, I'd say Alex Jones is controlled opposition.
Yes, exactly. You know, yes.
That's a better phrase, I think.
Yes. That's what, so, but I watched, you know, his coverage of that back then, and he says so many crazy things, but he did not concentrate on that very much at all. He gave it a little bit of play at Wolfgang Halbeg on there, who I had on my podcast later, but who was a former school official there. But I tell people, first of all, yeah, I think it's irresponsible to say somebody didn't die or whatever like that. And but I think there's ways to question it, and there's lots to question about that. But you just figure, okay, I don't know what happened, but here are the facts. You know, there were no EMS personnel. They tell you they didn't let any people into the building to attend to the injured, the kids that have been shot.
You know what? They we had exactly the same in Manchester, exactly the same mm-hmm. as Manchester Arena bombing. The police who arrived first on the scene, who were very, very quick there, prevented all the paramedic trained firefighters and paramedics from getting to the scene. They said, oh, we believe there's still another device. We have this very often. And so people are there just left to die. The paramedics are kept away by a special type of cop like anti-terror police. And this is another aspect which is not getting anywhere near enough coverage. The idea that something has happened and the whole scene of it is being sanitized by some super cop putting a cordon around and making sure that the entire crime scene is sanitized right. before anyone gets a chance to have a look at it.
Yeah, and here there certainly wasn't any threat of a bomb or anything going off. And in Sandy Hook. It's just that it, unheard of to have a bunch of kids who had been shot and some grownups as well, and you don't allow EMT personnel to go inside? Literally, and that's not me saying it. That's not a conspiracy theory. They tell you that. That was one of the things that people first questioned. And there's the helicopter footage of that day as well. I've seen it. Now, a lot of this stuff has been scrubbed from the internet, but it was out there before. This was local television stations flying a helicopter above the school and, you know, showing the scene. And I'm telling you, if you watch the scene, it looks like a day at the park. There's no signs of pandemonium anywhere. It doesn't look like anything's going on. So I don't know what that means.
Well, maybe, but, it's, you know, inside, maybe it's all inside the school.
Well, but this is after the aftermath, so that you should have had, they have a triage set up, but no, there were no victims set up because there are no EMT personnel. There's tons of questions about about what happened that day, and you should be able to.
Yeah, of course.
I just do.
I draw a line on this whole idea of saying that people who have lost loved ones haven't, or speculating even, you know, saying, oh, well, we think this person could just be an actor, you know, who's right. crying at a funeral.
That's true. But you know what we just, and I, in my book Bullyocracy, I wrote and I discovered, because we do have people think crisis actors are some conspiracy. Crisis actors are a very real thing. There used to be a website called Crisis. And our schools in America still to this day, they run what they call live shooter drills, and they do it. They've done it all the time. They don't tell the children. Most of the time they're in elementary schools. Now you talk about psychological damage. You're a little kid. Your child is going to school, and they think there's a live shooter there. It's an actor.
Well, I mean, we had this. It's funny you mention it, because just near where I live here in St. Paul's in central Bristol, we've got a cordon. I just drove out, and there's suddenly a police cordon all around the area. Oh, we think it's the copper was initially reluctant, but I pressed him, and I wouldn't go away. So he said, we think it's what they call a sus package, right? A suspect package. And eventually I managed to prize a copy from one of the local social media people later on that day. And it's quite obviously someone has put together what looks like a kind of fake bomb. But my immediate thoughts are, is this actually just an exercise? Did the police put this here? You know, we're not, there is, the thing is that the law around all this stuff is, that the police can do that. They can just place something there and say, right, this is a real event. And they know it's an exercise, none of the rest of us do. So they're starting to blur the whole idea of
a real
terror event with exercise. And it seems to me that's all deliberate.
And that's why I said, when people question Sandy Hook or Parkland or any of these, Boston bombing, any of these other events, I think it's perfectly, it's a logical thing. If you know that the schools are doing this stuff routinely, and they use crisis actors, they use fake blood.
Well, I know what you're saying. Yes, you can question it. You know, yes, of course you can question it. But if you are making accusations that someone who's lost a loved one didn't lose a loved one, you better be able to stand that one up.
Oh, of course.
Before you publish it. Anyway,
oh, never do that.
What about this use of fear?
Yeah, well, that's because I think it's all, and that's why I wanted to write about fear. I think we saw the greatest fear porn that you've ever seen. I mean, you saw what happened. People are willing to give up everything. I mean, Hollywood has been killed because of fear, because they let the industry die. Sports, you know, as people stop going to sports. People, how many loved ones died in nursing homes? Old people who didn't get to hug their grandkids another time, who didn't get to see grandkids, even when they saw them, they were scared to hug. You didn't hug each other because, you might catch COVID. You had to stay 6 feet apart, which was a made up figure, has no science at all to that whatsoever. Young people that, you know, they were afraid to, you know, spring fever, you know, looking for love. Well, you couldn't do that during COVID. So it really messed with basic human traits and characteristics that have been around since as long as we've been around. And it was all because people were terrified of this virus that was hovering, this invisible virus. And as I said, you know, is most noticeable when people went to restaurants. And I remember making a scene, but then I finally said, I'm not going to embarrass my family anymore. And nobody cares. The people at the restaurant aren't, they're just following, you know, they're just doing what they want to keep their jobs. But, you know, you walked into the restaurant, you had to wear a mask to walk inside. But as soon as you got to the table, you could take it off. And so I said, okay, this is a strange virus. It hovers around the doorway, but once you get inside, it's okay. And as I wrote in my book, Masking the Truth, Anthony Fauci, who was one of the great villains here, he was famous behind the scenes. He thought that was hilarious, how he got people to do something that stupid. Can you believe they're taking the, you know, they put the mask on it and then they go to the table and take it off? I mean, he was laughing at how stupid we were. And I tried to say, come on, people, think here. But you couldn't get them to think. And I don't know how many people.
It's fascinating. It's a fascinating exercise in social control. And I can remember in Stroud in Gloucestershire, I was asked to come along and talk at a protest there. And I was walking along next to a lady, probably in her early 80s or something. And she was quite freely chatting to me with the microphone running. She said it wasn't as bad as this during the war.
Yeah, sure, of course not. No, absolutely. I mean, this was something we had. And as I said, you know, the flu had killed as many as 80,000 people in 1 year in the United States just a few years before this. Nothing was ever shut down for that. Nothing was ever canceled because of a flu or anything like that. When they tried to say, you know, they had like a SARS and Ebola. Ebola is much deadlier than any of this stuff. Nothing was ever canceled because of that. Mm. And so I think this was an exercise. It was, it goes back, as I talked about in my book, goes back to the dark winter of 2001, when they had this first tabletop exercise with Bill Gates, the World Health Organization, CDC, all the usual suspects, and they started planning a simulation for what happens. And it was always escaping from China in all their simulations. It always came from China. What if a deadly virus comes from China and it causes a pandemic? How do we develop a vaccine for it? They had several, I recounted them all in my book, several of these tabletop exercises leading up to Agenda 201, which was right before COVID hit, whatever COVID was. And the guy, Kerry Mulls, who invented the PCR test, in which all this nonsense was based on, and who told everyone, look, this test is not, you don't use this for detect viruses. It's going to give you whatever result you want. So we got a 90% false positive rate. That's what the home test kits were based on. The hospital tests that got $13,000 for a fake diagnosis out of our stimulus funds. Just so much here, so much corruption that it's beyond belief. But the problem is, you talk about the JFK assassination or 9/11, any of these other conspiracies, the government and the court historians have a lot invested in that, in those lies. They never want to admit they were wrong. But COVID is really, the entire world is invested in it because, you know, the vast majority fell for it. All officials fell for it. And so they're never going to admit that the crazy conspiracy kooks.
But there was also this other aspect, wasn't there, that even if people didn't fall for it, they felt like they had to pretend they'd fallen for it.
Sure. I mean, by that, I had already become a full-time writer by then. I was no longer in the working world. But if I had been, I'm sure my family would have put a lot of pressure on me to get, because I would have had to get the jab to keep, because I worked for a healthcare organization in IT. And, you know, I made good money. So I might have been pressured to do it, or, you know, I don't know. My marriage might have broken up. I don't know. But so that's I understand why people did it. To keep their jobs.
Let's try and sort of close this off by looking at where you think this might all be leading to, because this is a pretty dystopian picture we're painting, which it seems to be new dimensions being added to it all the time. But what ultimately are the elite up to? The Bilderbergers, the banks, you know, we're talking here about a kind of super elite cult, effectively.
Yeah, that's the big question. And that's, you know, goes back to, I talk about 1984 a lot. Orwell's 1984, I think it's a good handbook for where we are today in a lot of ways. And Winston Smith, the hero of 1984, he asked the question I've asked myself many times. And that is, he said, you know, he knows who's doing this. He obviously knows where it is and how it's being done, but he doesn't know why. Why? I still don't know why, because these people have all the power they could ever want. They've shown over and over again, COVID certainly demonstrated how gullible and obedient the public is. So they don't have to worry about any kind of rebellion, because the rebellious spirit has been crushed in the vast majority of people. People can't come together, just like Orwell's Proles. We can't come together on anything.
Well, look, so okay, so that let me try and answer that, because you look at somebody like King Charles, who's in an extremely powerful position, immensely wealthy, even so powerful that he can keep the amounts of his wealth off the Sunday Times rich list. As Kevin Carhill's said on the shows, one of the researchers on the Sunday Times explained how the royals quietly twisted the arm of Rupert Murdoch to make sure that they fell down the scale. So he's got that sort of power. And you do wonder quite exactly what, you know, he's also very immensely powerful in the whole climate movement, the a conference of the parties, the COP series. He's one of the major movers behind the war in Ukraine. So even though he's not elected as an individual. So it seems pretty obvious to me what's driving people like him is the, and if you look at his personal life, and you examine some of the relationships he's had with individuals around him, you'll see that he doesn't broach any disagreement. So if you disagree with him in his close personal circle, you're out, basically. So he just wants to be surrounded by sycophants. He wants to be surrounded by yes men. And I think that's the mentality that sort of works its way down through the rest of society in a society governed by somebody who's invulnerable like that. And so we are in the UK. We're not a democracy. Of course, we are actually a monarchy, and we're now a kind of medieval style monarchy where you have puppet prime ministers. And, you know, the way Britain is supposed to work is that the prime minister makes decisions. Well, what happens when you appoint a prime minister who does everything he's told, and he's a very pliable little chap, and he will, you know, be obedient to you? He'll appoint the ministers you want him to appoint. He'll appoint the chief constables, the army officers, the judges that you want him to. And so that, it seems to me, is what's driving this, Don, maybe, is just simply it's a sort of trickle down effect from the top. The idea is from, you know, the person at the top has decided that they want absolute control and they won't broach any dissent.
No, I think you're right, especially at that level. Because, again, most of us think that there's a group above it all. And, you know, there a lot of people still believe in the Illuminati, which is a very real organization, that it's just kind of a, not supernatural, but just a super elitist thing.
Well, hang on, because they were European aristocracy, weren't they? And good old Charlie's from a great German Saxe-Coburg-Gotha aristocratic family.
Right. Well, it started, and certainly we had people like Adam Weishaupt is the one that founded the modern Illuminati. And we know, I mean, Thomas Jefferson talked about him. George Washington talked about it. There was some concern there. They infiltrated the Freemasonic lodges. And that's why the Masons still are looked at by so many people in the conspiracy world as, you know, being running things, because the Illuminati infiltrating them and making them something else. You know, more sinister, like they worship Lucifer or something. I don't know. But that's, you know, it's hard to figure out what the big why is. I think that, you know, since I've been studying eugenicists so much, that the eugenicists really, and certainly in COVID, I think if you can look for a motivation for them to pull off what I call the greatest psyop in the history of the world, they wanted to kill a lot of people, because they talk about it all the time over the Prince Philip. You know, he was asked twice, on two different occasions in his life, if you could come back and be reincarnated as anything, what would you want to be? Both times he said he wanted to be a deadly virus to kill millions of people. Now, what kind of a person, that's what you want to come back as? You had people like Jacques Cousteau that said the same thing, Ted Turner, that it's their fantasy.
And yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because there's no way now that they'd motivate enough people to go and join the army. But what they can do, of course, is they can press a button on a computer, which will send a drone to do whatever it is, the dirty work that they want. And that seems to me that maybe it's an interesting little discussion, this, because that may be simply why we've got this kind of Elon Musk technocracy rising, is because the people won't be compliant with this oligarchy, this elite. So they're going to have to get a whole bunch of computers to either tell us what to do, turn off our money, or send a drone.
Yes. Yeah, no, it is. And again, as I said, to understand what the overlying motive is, I think we're in a spiritual battle. like you, I'm a Christian. I was raised Catholic. I believe strongly in Jesus. I think that the people we are confronting, I don't think there's any other way to explain what their motivations are, because they do some absolutely evil things. And I think it's inspired by the darkest force imaginable. So I think there's a satanic influence there. And I think, you know, Huey Long, one of the many great things he said he was asked to explain something like this. And, you know, he was talking about the disparity of wealth and how, you know, the people, the very few rich had grabbed all the money, and you had so many people that were suffering, and how can they let that happen? He said, look, you know, it's not enough for these people to have everything. They have to look at you and know you don't have it. And I think he hit the nail on the head, at least at that level. I think that they get off on, and I see it all the time in people questioning, you know, how's that guy in food stamps, and how does he have a big screen TV? That's the mentality they have, but they don't question corporate wealth.
That's how they kind of fill the hole in their heart where God should be.
Yeah, that's exactly. And so I think that, you know, we're looking at I think if they're eugenicists, if they believe, first of all, there are too many people and too many of the wrong people, that's what eugenicists think. Eugenicists think we have to get rid.
By the way, there aren't too many people. There is plenty of land and food for everybody. It's just the system, the economic system, just channels that food to the wrong. I mean, look at the Irish famine, things like that. This was food that was being taken out of Ireland. The same with Ukrainian famines. Anyway, can we just wind up with you reminding us of your book titles, website, and how people can follow you, Don?
Yeah, and I think, well, the one book I left out was my most recent book, American Memory Hole, How the Court Historians Promote Disinformation, and that's basically Hidden History 3. And so you can get a combination of Hidden History and Crimes and Cover-Ups. So we start with the founding again, so you have some new stuff about Jefferson and the founders, a lot more about Lincoln, lots more about FDR inventing cancel culture, and lots more about JFK assassination, 9/11, Oklahoma City, and JFK Jr. So have, you know, people that like the first two books will love this book, and you can buy that anywhere. And my Substack, the only place I'm not shadow banned is Donald Jeffries at Substack.com. I protest. You can catch up to my write regularly there, two or three times a week, so you'll keep up with my take on events. And you can follow me. You can try follow me on Twitter, X now. And since Elon Musk took over, my shadow ban has eased up a bit there. It's at Don Jeffries on X, but Substack is the main way to go. You subscribe to me there, and you'll find out probably more than you want to know.
Well, I was chatting with Anton Chaikin recently. I don't know if you've read his stuff, but he says he thinks Jefferson was a British agent.
Who said this?
Anton Chaikin. His book is called Who We Are, America's Fight for
Unity. Oh, yes. People told me about him. Yeah. I don't know if he was a British agent. Jefferson's one of my heroes. I don't know.
This is what agents are very good at, being super appealing. But the idea is you're feeding stuff constantly back to your bosses over the other side of the Atlantic.
Well, he was very good if he was. Because he's fooled me. He's still fooling me. But I don't look at that. he's one of my great heroes. I still quote him often. And, it's trying to figure out exactly what's all I can do is look at it and say, you know, that these are the problems we have in America and around the world. They're easy to resolve, but they are easy. But the problem is most of the people that are in a position to resolve them, the leaders of every country in the world, are the haves. They have a lot of wealth.
Yeah.
And it would require them to give up something, to sacrifice something to solve the problem.
They wouldn't even notice it. They wouldn't even notice it.
But they won't do it.
So look, just for, I'll try and end on a kind of positive note. Which of your books has got a little bit of a kind of something which can leave us with a bit of light at the end of the tunnel, maybe even suggesting directions to take to avoid the, I mean, it is inevitable, but just to make sure you're kind of on the right side when the final battle takes place.
Well, I think, you know, I have some hope in me. I watched a lot of Frank Capra films. I believe in the fairy tale ending. So I got that in my head, even though I'm so dark and cynical and I think everything's so corrupt. I know that we can still win the people because we outnumber them by the billions around the world. It's just a question of getting people to work in their own best interest. I would say Survival of the Richest is probably the book that people, well, actually On Borrowed Fame people might, I wrote that about showbiz. So people, it's kind of, it's not, but it's, you know, it's got a lot of darkness in it as well. Cause I talk about people getting ripped off and some of the mysteries there, but you know, to say which one of all my books, I think, I don't think they ever sound like I'm too much in despair. Survival of the Richest, it's very easy to solve that. And that is to force the sharing of wealth. And I go over Huey Long's plan, and we could do something like that now. But again, it will require people.
Well, we may actually have to. And let's finish off with the sentiment around the idea that many of the super powerful, so they think, they actually believe their own propaganda. So they believe. I mean, we had that whole thing with Wesley Clark, didn't we? 7 countries in 5 years. Well, sorry, yes. Mate. But you never got anywhere near that. So you're way behind the plan. And everyone is catching up with what you're up to far quicker than you realize. So there's this element of the sycophancy, which means you get you surround yourself with people who are yes men and actually not as competent as the other side. So in a way, it's inevitable that they're on a hiding to nothing. This is quite a nice concept, isn't it?
Sure. And it's again, they profit from the fact
that we get the hiding. This is the trouble.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, they have convinced you people that, as Gerald Celente is a great guy over here, does some good work. He likes to say people like Trump or Bill Gates, people. So almost all these wealthy, and in my book, Survival to Get Riches, I go over the backgrounds of almost, not all, but most of the famous people I could think of. And there's no rags to riches stories. They all came from at least upper middle class families. There are lies about it. Abraham Lincoln's father was the largest landowner in his state. By the way, you know, you think he came from a little log cabin. These are lies and myths to make you think there's upward mobility. There isn't, but you have to, if the people got together, they can make a difference. And so somebody like Huey Long made a difference in his state. He improved a lot of Louisianans just, you know, by doing something to force the people that had something to sacrifice a little. And that's the problem we have today, that everybody wants to come up with to whatever problems that need to be solved. Nobody looks at the people who have the world money. We have enough money in America. When I wrote the updated paperback that Naomi Wolf wrote forward to Survival of the Richest, we discovered that if you divided up all the money in America, every man, woman, and child, and that's the known wealth. That includes the stuff in the foundations, which have never been audited, the offshore profits. This is just the known wealth. It would come to $344,000 for every man, woman, and child. Now, I'm not saying we do that, but that shows you how much wealth is there.
Yeah, and it makes every family a millionaire, doesn't it?
Exactly. So why is anybody living in the street?
Amazing. Anyway, yeah. Listen, fascinating to chat to you again. Don Jeffries, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Tony. Appreciate it.